This is the Living Legacy Project with Monica Engel at the Birchfield Penny Arts Center on October 2nd, 2014. And Monica, thank you so much for coming in today to meet with us here at the museum.
Thank you, Heather. I'm really honored to be here and be part of this project.
We are too. You know, we're in our third year now, and we have completed over 30 interviews with living artists in the region. And, you know, the more we do this, the more we realize how many incredible artists there are for us still to reach out to. And having the opportunities to be like, okay, you know, now's the time. Now we can really reach out to even more people is really powerful for us. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you. It's an exciting network of artists and this connections. When I came in, I was looking at the Janelle Lynch, the presence downstairs. And I started to think about Catherine Parker and Joe Orfeo, and I feel one of the things about being in Buffalo, I was so lucky to have moved here 8 years ago, mm-hmm. and that I was able to know them and work with them, mm-hmm. and exhibit alongside them through galleries here, both with Grace Maibaum and Elizabeth Samuels.
Yeah.
So. You know, it's part of what makes Buffalo really an incredible community, and that multi-generational component,
yeah.
I think, really.
And I wish I could have had an opportunity to interview Catherine Parker while she was still with us, but we did interview Joe Orfeo in our first year with the Living Legacy Project in 2012, and quite honestly, that was like the most wonderful interview. He was just the warmest person, you know, and just everything he said came from such a place of kindness. And his wife Linda was there with us, and we got to really have a nice dynamic talking. And he was incredible. And he used to call me on, I went back to grad school in Vancouver, and he would call me on Skype like all the time, and we would talk sometimes. And he would also Skype with William West, who is another artist that we interviewed that year, because the two of them had known each other since the 40s. And we're finally, you know, not as mobile as they had been, but because of Skype, they were still able to connect. But Joe, for me, was a really powerful example of why we're doing this, you know, because I got to interview him in summer, and then 6 months later, he passed away. And I was like, oh my God, I'm so grateful we had this opportunity to have this conversation while we could, because we didn't have much longer to have that conversation.
Right, and it was prime time for him because he was just so sharp about everything, and he really did keep up with when you were talking about the Skype, he was always posting something on whatever social media he was using at the time and sharing his artwork, too. This is what I'm working on. So
I know, he sent me so many pictures of what he was working on, and I just loved it. And just hearing about like his wheat field series that he was working on towards the end, you know, and just his love of the light through the wheat grass. And I'm just like, ah. And unfortunately, that also highlights for me, you know, this last year we reached out to both Marion Fowler and Bruce Kurland for last year's class. And even though I was in early conversations with both of them, neither of them felt healthy enough to participate. And unfortunately, a few months apart, then passed away, each of them separately. And for me, I still feel that kind of like this stone in my stomach where I'm like, oh, we missed something that we're never going to get a chance to do again, you know? And I try not to take that too personally, but I can kind of feel that. So the good news is with each of them, I think we're going to interview Tom Daly and Justine Daly about Bruce Kurland, because they were
a great way to bring the story and bring that narrative to life.
And my hope is also to interview Marion Fowler's son about his mother, you know, and his father, and Hollis Frampton, which would be really, really incredible as well. So there are other ways, you know, it's not primary source, but then again, oral history isn't so much about, it is about facts, but it's also about feeling, you know, it's not about like a minute moment that you can pin down. It's about how those moments are interpreted through our lived experience. And, you know, my very dry archival professors would tell you that that's not important, as important as the primary source document, but I disagree completely, you know. I think that it's not just about the document, it's about how that documentation affected your life. So I find that to be much more powerful, or equally powerful, let's say. You need it all, so.
Right. Legacy is part of the title for the project. So interviewing the other generations or the colleagues, or there's a really it's a way to still preserve that moment in time.
Yeah. You're a concept smith. We like to say about Scott Propiak that he's a wordsmith, because he can just, like, he can just throw out a title before an exhibition exists, and you got the title, and then everything else develops around it, you know? But you're very good with the concepts. That's very nice.
Well, thank you. Being, you know, just walking into this building, it's inspiring just being here.
Yeah, it is. To get into the questions for the interview, I'd like you to talk a little bit about what inspired you to want to pursue a career in the arts, or to want to be an artist, or really, you know, give that sort of creative energy space and focus in your life.
I feel like there wasn't any necessarily one thing, but I grew up in a family of, everyone was a scientist. Both my parents were physicians, and actually my siblings are also physicians. So, but we always were making things, and my mother kept a dark room, and my father kept a woodworking shop, and so we were always, constructing things. Mm-hmm. So the hands-on, I guess it's the hands-on component, I would just get dropped off at the art museum. I grew up in Omaha, Nebraska, mm-hmm. So I would get dropped off, my mother would drop me off Saturday mornings when she would be going to the hospital to work, and so I would just... That was where I spent my free time. So it was a fun and very, a little bit of everything. I got to do art classes. I got to kind of know everybody at the museum really well, and they knew me. So that was
community babysitting.
Yes, it was. It was a little. Right? It was a very. This would have been the 70s in Omaha, so it was, that was fine. But so I was really able to, looking back on it, these things, just one thing contributed to the other.
Yeah.
And having that, so both having the exposure just to looking at mm-hmm. thing and just having those really young memories of going to a museum mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. having that be part of your world. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was so fortunate mm-hmm. to be able to have that be part of my growing up. And
yeah, they do say that I'm sure it's not complete, but it's not completely true, but statistics have shown that if you don't go to a museum as a child, you don't feel comfortable in museums as an adult, and you're mm-hmm. less likely to take your kids there when you have them, because in some ways museums can be very intimidating. It's a space where there's this perceived intellectualism, and you're told not to touch anything, and what if you don't like the art,
right.
As if that's, and not knowing that it's totally okay and fine not to like it, And so, but yeah, it's throughout childhood that we really form the ways of engaging in those spaces, that maybe we don't so much as adults.
And I think that that word of being comfortable mm-hmm. and whether it's just comfortable looking or comfortable experiencing.
Like home. Yeah.
Yes.
Museums always feel really safe to me. Like, I know I can just go and sit on a bench and just be, But that's because of my learned experiences mm-hmm. as a kid as well.
Right.
Museums. Yeah.
Yes.
When did that transition from, museum art classes to, because you, well, I'll get into the next stage with your education.
You're right. And that. So, and I think that there were, so when I went to Harvard College and did my undergrad degree there. And again, I was very lucky because I had an advisor who was in the Department of Visual Environmental Studies. So but he was also in the folklore department. And I ended up concentrating in folklore because I could take all my studio art classes, and they would count as part of my degree. But then I was able to also pursue things that were just kind of I ended up studying classics, so I did ancient Greek and modern Greek. So I think I was able to really spend a lot of time with people asking questions about what does it mean to be human, which I think as time went on and as I've then was able to take those lessons and those thoughts and they have really come to form the basis of how I think about art and, mm-hmm. and why it's important mm-hmm. and why we need it, need it around us and support it.
Major in folklore, that's really cool. I haven't heard, you hear the classics and stuff like that, but hearing it described as folklore, I think gives you a different just like it like enters into similar places from a slightly different space.
Right. Well, and you were talking before about just the use of sources and talking about from your perspectives of archives or from other. So I think with folklore and this and studying about how do we collect and transcribe and record things that are created, whether they're or in the purpose in which the environment in which they're created.
Yeah. So what is creation? Does creation mean there's a physical record, or is it stories told generation by generation,
right.
And who's the creator in something like that? It's every generation, because it's like a game of telephone. It changes a little bit, but it's still these themes,
right? And what was always interesting with that with the folklore start, that looking at the elements that are when they're alive in the culture and they haven't been necessarily, they're not locked down, they're able to change, they're not, it's not, I studied Greek folk songs, and it's not, and while it's part of the culture when it's being used and shared, but once it would get written down and set into one specific mode, then it ceases to it takes on a different function and role. But
yeah.
But that the I actually wrote a thesis where I was listening to Greek folk music and transcribing it, and then. So it was kind of a different sort of cultural mapping, I think, is the way at the time it had a visual element, because these were all songs that were involved with folk dance, and so then I was but it also involved what was the rhythm and the meter, and so it was there was a vocal element and the musical, but then it was being set to a pattern of movement. So for me, this allowed me to look at a lot of different kinds of cultural material and explore the, as I said, those big questions about what does it mean to be human? What does it mean to create?
It's interesting too, kind of what you were saying about how it becomes static when it's written down. Is it like, there's more reverence around it when it's finally written.
Right, and then you're not able to change it.
Right.
And it's that ability to change,
mm-hmm.
that's the, I think in terms of defining what is active in a culture and vital in the culture,
yeah.
is that you have this form that you can use, and there's areas for improvisation or extemporizing, but...
And individualism.
Right, but within something that everybody understands. So I think that I think with how there are a lot of interesting parallels to how art affects our culture and or what do we think are the common aspects of our culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, kind of a off-topic tie-in, but that's kind of what I like about the Barge right now. The current exhibition of Displacement at the Birchfield Penny Arts Center, which is this prototype of a barge that is 100 feet by 30 feet and has 9 galleries inside of it. Okay, backstory done. But just that, it takes this thing that we conceptualize historically and statically as, donkeys and barges and old songs and something that's dead to us, but we live with the wreckage of, down in the canals and the grain elevators here in Buffalo. But it takes that and says, actually, we can still play with it, and we can still play with what our relationship is to the barge and the canal and these concepts. But yeah.
Right, and,
yeah,
and those and
that.
Those physical right, and that there are these physical forms,
yeah.
that are being referenced or not both recreated and repurposed by
yeah.
turning it into a
gallery.
We've
yeah.
got this shape of a bar that's
yeah.
that's holding something else.
Yeah, how can we take this almost reverential structure and fill it with contemporary things that relate to our lives rather than donkeys. that's the
right.
first thing I think of
right.
when I think of the Erie Canals, the donkeys on the side pulling the boats and that sort of thing.
Yeah,
which will not be happening if we get an actual barge. No donkeys will be involved in the process.
And the with the kind of where the folklore led to was then I did my graduate degree in cultural geography. I was a geography major. So I was, I think I've the landscape component was a big part mm-hmm. of looking at the constructed landscape and saying, what does this tell us about the people who made them, made these structures, and it's both the shaped and both building, anything that basically is kind of the whether it's agricultural change or building change. And I just was really drawn to explore those questions and work on those, and then that led me, I did that at Penn State, and then after that my husband and I moved to Los Angeles because he was going to law school out there, and then I worked for the Craft and Folk Art Museum out in LA, which is still across the street from the La Brea Tar Pits and uh-huh. the LA County Museum. So I just wanted to get involved with art. I've felt like art education was a real key to how people discover art and share art. Was
art education is an incredibly powerful part of what museums do, and especially I think at a time where, in many ways the education system is becoming very reductive down to all these testing structures and really not providing much space for critical thinking, or the development of critical thinking capacities. I feel like museum education or non-traditional education in many ways, it doesn't just have to be in a museum, but hands-on learning, and pedagogy. It's one of these few places where you can still really learn through experience and hone your ability to come to your own conclusions, So yeah, it's really powerful to me.
And what was nice about that program at that time too was they had a real hands-on yeah. component. So I was able to have a studio. I had a home studio, and then I also was working in a hands-on studio with the school tour, groups yeah. and tours, and then one of the big things they did there was a mask making project. So, and you would appreciate working with identifying cultural practitioners who had come from other cultures, were living in Los Angeles, and were still participating in their traditional forms and creating these objects that were used and were danced. So for me it was like the perfect transitional. But as time went on, obviously I just wanted to spend more and more time in my studio and doing my own art. But it was, I think there's definitely been a component of my career throughout where we then moved to Minneapolis, and I worked for Walker Arts Center and did the same thing, working in their education program and a combination of public touring and there was also a hands-on mm-hmm. classroom element. So
kind of thinking about, your time in LA and sort of working with very diverse cultures and a very diverse community in LA, I guess it's something I've been thinking about a lot recently. What's the difference between appreciation and appropriation? And what's that distinction between really celebrating another culture that's not your own and in some ways not being aware of the ways in which you are reinforcing oppressive structures by co-opting components of another culture without acknowledging the full extent of your impact, especially when it's of a traditionally marginalized community or something like that, right?
Right. Are you getting a type of engagement where, or just that word participation, where people are able to put forth, I think if they're actively sharing what their culture is about, and I think it's that it's coming from the group that is...
The originating community.
Right. Right.
So I was just thinking, in that time when you were in this really culturally rich and diverse place of working at, and it's, what was the name of the museum?
Oh, it's Craft and Folk Art yeah. Museum, so okay. CAFAM. Yeah. yeah.
And then going back to your studio, what was some of your work like at that time?
So definitely I think with, color was huge, obviously, and in terms of things that I've always looked at, but it was very, I think, one thing that was nice about what was going on in that gallery space at that time was there were historic objects, things that had been collected over time, and then there was an effort because of the diversity that was in and continues to be in the city of Los Angeles, that you had groups that were connected to those objects and could, and since most of them had a performative base, would come into the gallery space and really activate it. And for me, that's just that I think there was there, whether they were, you know, even though I was, you know, I think I'm much more relentlessly two-dimensional, but that performance piece was really important. And I think that energy and just bringing those, you know, taking something that's static and bringing it to life. So I think for that's really the association that I have with that time and place.
I was very lucky to work at the Museum of Anthropology in Vancouver because it was at UBC, you know, and yes. I worked in the archives there, and you know they have this incredible collection of First Nations masks, which, you know, it's a complicated relationship with why they have the masks in the first place. They essentially took advantage of the fact that First Nations communities had been broken down over the past 100 years of Canadian government policies, and by the time MOA reached out in the 60s and said, we'd like to purchase some of your masks, they were, you know, strapped for money, and also acknowledged very well that these First Nations communities, that selling the mask of a raven does not remove the power of the raven from the person who is raven or who carries that in certain ceremonies, you know, mm-hmm. that sort of thing. And it does not remove the power of the elders and that sort of thing. So they were able to logically disconnect that and still hold on to their culture and say, yeah, you can take our mask and give us the money, you know. That they had to do that in the first place was very problematic. But MOA is amazing about trying to both build lasting connections with First Nations communities, letting the First Nations communities determine the scope of exhibition and storage of things. You know, like there's certain masks that are not supposed to be in the same space as other masks. There are certain masks that, even if it's a huge drawer, you know, are never supposed to be viewed by other masks. So you have a massive drawer and you have one piece in it, and you make sure that it is never viewed by the other pieces, you know. So they're really good at working with the communities to respect their cultures.
Right. And I love that idea of those, that the object is looking out.
Yeah.
It's not that we're not just looking in at it. It's
looking out at us too.
So,
yeah.
And not that, but I've, because I always feel about my work, I always want it to be conversational. And I think we're going to take a look at the series of pieces that even if I'm making things one at a time, that I want them to talk to one another.
And those pieces in the River Crossing series speak so strongly to each other.
I think going back to that time, there's the aspect of color and then just the placemaking. I think that there's that part of that, and maybe that goes with the performance, mm-hmm. that it's taking, you know, that it's rooted in a physical space. And so I think that maybe was, and coming out of the cultural landscape study, that I think that was really making that connection for me at that time, was that it had, that you're seeing, and maybe living in Los Angeles then, which was without seasons, that it really made me feel like I became aware that I missed them intensely because of the ability to return to a place over time and have that change over the season and have that, those environmental shifts.
Yeah, make you think of where you've been in different falls throughout your life.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
And what was it like this time last year and the year before and all of that? Yeah. I don't think I could ever live in L.A., quite honestly.
Right. You must have had in Vancouver. That's it. You have a little bit of that West Coast.
Right.
But you certainly had more seasonal variation.
Yes, yes. Mostly it was just like the growing season is so long up there, you know, and spring, you see the first crocuses in February, you know. So in some ways, I was just coming off of years of living in Buffalo. I was like, what is this? You know, this is amazing. So, but it's a very rainy, you know, like here my winter jacket is a down coat that is good to -20, you know,
right.
And that thing just soaked up water in Vancouver, and so I couldn't wear it, you know, I wore it once, and then I'm like, this is the wrong jacket.
Right.
Because it just rains all winter. It just rains all winter. And it gets so deep into your bones. I'd almost take, you know, I don't know, I don't have a car, I bus, I bike, I bus it all winter, and this past winter was brutal, but I prefer the cold because it's at least, I don't know, it's very, there's something about the bracing nature of it where it's like, it's a punch in the face, but you can push back. Whereas kind of with the rain, it doesn't matter if you have an umbrella or not, it's just going to get in you. It's
right,
just
going to get right.
in you all the time, and it's never going to actually get out. And you're never going to dry out, truthfully. Right. You
know? Well, and I feel the same way about the heat.
Yeah.
That I'm much so, because we went from Los Angeles to Minneapolis. So it was, and I was much more comfortable because you can always put on more clothes.
You can always put on more clothes. You can't take off your skin.
Right. You need to be able to find that comfort zone.
That is exactly what I say about heat versus cold. Because in the heat, I just, you know, even in the heat of, because Buffalo has very hot summers mostly. This was sort of not that hot, but this past year. But I just wilt and sit in the shade and whine for just months at a time. And I'm just like, don't touch me. But it's a beautiful, you know, it was a scary early September here. It was very cold. I was like, no, it can't be over. But we are now having a beautiful resurgence of pleasant skies. So, yay.
Oh, it's right.
Right
it's
now,
been a beautiful,
beautiful
start to
it
fall.
Has, yeah.
Right, right. No, yeah. the summer.
We lucked out.
Yeah.
Oh, good. Okay. So, you know, the last thing I want to say about the mask, and I'm not trying to harp on your time there, but just thinking about masks now and, like, my experiences with MOA, seeing the First Nations communities doing the performances with their masks, you
yes.
know, and you see the vibrancy of the actions and things like that, you realize that the way we view them in a museum capacity on the walls or something like that is not what they were created for and not where they're supposed to be in many ways, just in a static case.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're made to be in motion. And
and that performing.
Yeah, is very much integral to what the mask is, you know, and then we take it into a Western context and put it in a different frame so that we can preserve it in many ways, you know, but yeah, that
right.
was the most powerful part for me working at MOA.
Well, and we started talking about just that where you're not trying to impose one cultural view on these, because I did a lot of work in the going into public schools, so we would take the, do mask making residencies and bring artists in. And it certainly, I think, it was interesting because you were taking this one form where you had students who had come from a variety of cultures where masks were part of their culture, but it might not be the what you might be talking about a Japanese mask, whereas they grew up in a state of Mexico with a, you know, with a different mask
mm-hmm.
tradition,
mm-hmm.
but they're certainly familiar
mm-hmm.
with the form.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a good connecting point.
That's really cool.
But I think that for students, they could
right.
imagine themselves in it or get to the power of it.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. So when you moved to Minneapolis, did you notice a shift in your own work? And we haven't talked about any sort of like the total themes of your work or that
right.
sort of thing, but
right.
we'll get to that. But when you moved to Minneapolis, how did that influence your artistic production?
Oh, well, I think that the main thing for me when I moved there is I got involved with, there's Minneapolis College of Art and Design had, and still has, a great printmaking and bookmaking. And then there was also the Minnesota Center for Book Arts,
mm-hmm.
Which, you know, Buffalo is now lucky to have its own, you know, Western New York Book Arts Center. And and they were definitely, one was modeled on, you know, and for, you know, helped be a model
mm-hmm.
for the other. But having access to I had done a little bit of print in college. I'd been able to do a little bit of printmaking. It was more like an open studio, but I never had time to do more than a partial class. And so then really being able to get involved with that, and that just was for me like, oh my gosh, I never want to leave here, you know. I loved printmaking. And then that led to really getting involved with the book arts community, and which, so there were some just fabulous people, you know, who are, you know, many of whom are still working in the Twin Cities now, and
mm-hmm.
so that was definitely the major transition, because I think up to that point, you know, through college and the time after, I had really been doing painting, mostly acrylics and oils, but just larger format painting on canvas or paper. But I guess I always loved painting on paper, and that's definitely been throughout. But then just having that, being able to take something, we talked a little about the two-dimensionality, then taking that two-dimensional surface and then folding it and turning it into a book, or even with printing, just the whole hand printing a page and then folding it up and turning it into a book, that was a key transition for me. And I feel like my work continues. I take things from painting, I take things from printmaking, I take things from bookmaking, and try to, use the elements to, in a way that doesn't, where they can blend together.
Well, kind of like touching on that, is maybe a good time to ask the next question about like the totality of your body of work. And I just skipped.
Yeah. Oh, that's, skipped, don't, okay, yeah, that's cool. Fine.
I just skipped about talking about your influences, but you can just sort of like bring those in as things happen.
That's
great.
Right.
But can you, kind of in that same vein of talking about your influences artistically and aesthetically, can you sort of like talk about the totality of your body of work? No pressure.
No pressure. I think the themes that I would keep going back to is that I guess it's exploring the surface. I liked when I was painting, I liked exploring the surface of the can, just that, you mentioned the idea of skin and covering your skin. You've got to get down to your own personal skin and that created skin, and with those influence, I obviously. Color field painting, for me, those big influences were looking at Rothko, and then Frankenthaler and Mitchell and some of the, and really those things that were all about how you could saturate the surface and then that gets to the idea of memory, that once, especially with, whether it's paper or fabric, it's going to remember what you did to it, and you, whatever medium you're applying to it, that there's going to be both how you physically touch it is going to affect what happens next. And so I think there's the surface element and the element of memory, and then there's that element of layering that I want to be able to, with whatever I'm whether I'm using whatever kind of ink or paint or watercolor or printer's ink, that I'm able to build something up by coming back and adding another layer. Mm-hmm. So there's, I think all of those, the printmaking component, I think is what's important, just that you're, when you print something, you take one kind of matrix and you draw on a surface or paint on a surface, and then in the simplest way you can just transfer it, put down a piece of paper and peel it off. But you've put those two things in contact with one another, and it's, and so you've altered your surface of your both the matrix you started with and then the substrate, whatever, or the material that you put it on. So I think I like that. There's a repetitive nature. There's the sort of there, and maybe that, we were talking before about things like dance movements and thing and performance things, where we rely a lot on repetition in our culture for a lot of different things, and it's just, and then how can we, I guess for me, for the art, it's how am I using those repetitions to come up with a sequence that's personal, but also leaves it open for the viewer to impose what they're bringing to it. That I'm trying to leave it open.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. So, thank you. That's a really great sort of like overview of some of your thoughts on many, many years of your work. That's very cool. I like thinking too. I don't know. Think about, but have you ever read anything by Italo Calvino?
Yes.
Have you read If on a Winter's Night a Traveler?
Oh yeah, yes.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite books in all of time. And so, that's very much about the relationship between the author and the reader, and what is that relationship, even though it's so, it's the reader gets to know the author, but the author never knows of the reader, and, you know, where is that, and that sort of thing. And if we imagine the painter and the viewer as, you know, the two surfaces connecting or forming a point of impact and then separating, but what is that if, you know, the artist doesn't necessarily know of the viewer, and the viewer doesn't necessarily know what the artist was trying to get at, and who cares what the artist was trying to get at in some
right.
ways, you know?
Right.
But what is that thread that links them that we can't ever really know, and that sort of thing. And also, what's the relationship between sort of, or is there a relationship, or just what's the thought process with sort of the, you know, when you said memory earlier about like what you're kind of putting into the surface of the painting, I was thinking of, okay, memory, the canvas's memory of what you've done to it is sort of a form of impact, you know, like you've impacted it. And how does that also tie into your, the way you've sort of been trained to think about culture and memory through your folklore training, you know, and sort of like what, if it's, you know, if it's an inanimate object, is it folklore? Is it painting lore? Is it, you know, what's the, is it object lore? You know, what
right.
sort of history are you helping create for the object and all of that? Anyway.
Yeah, and I think I use the, sometimes I think about it in terms of gestures that, and that what's things that maybe reappear, that I'm trying to express something about being able to go back to a place and whether it exists or not, or now maybe it only exists in my mind, but I need some way of returning to it. Mm-hmm. And so the those forms that I'm, by using the printmaking processes or things that I can, I say repeat, but you're never going to get the same result each time. You're going to get a slightly different result. So I think there's something to it that there's that, the physical that physical interaction, but and how does it reflect something that's just in, as I said, it's like a physical gesture that stands in for something that is in your head about how you how you remember a thing.
And what's that, what is the definition of nostalgia? Is it is it memory of something that maybe never existed or something like
right,
that.
Right,
right. You know,
or I almost feel it's like, you know, yeah, like when you're trying to remember something,
yeah.
but really you're never going to be able
right.
to. It's going to be, it's like that tip of the,
tip
tongue,
of the tongue. But you
or
feel it.
Swatting
like,
a, I kind
yeah.
of, I also feel it's like swatting a fly away. It's like the fly isn't really bothering you, but you need it to.
You need to have some reaction to it, yeah.
Right, right.
Yeah. And also, like, can your nostalgia create nostalgic feelings for others who don't even know what your nostalgia is,
right?
You know, and that sort of, that's just the
right.
Nature of art.
Well, and then I think that maybe that then the other thing that makes triggers for me is that idea of ephemerality. That there's the ephemeral nature of what we're trying to express. That we're, you know, and that and maybe they're impossible to express, or we can only get a version of it.
Approximations
at one time, and then you have another version, and then that gets back to that idea of the sequence of that we need to have one thing next to another to compare the, and I like that. So I like that idea of the viewer, or when you're talking about the Calvino with the book, that mm-hmm. that each reader viewer is bringing something, and it's too different to it. So the author is different. I mean, I don't know. Are you in a book group? I mean, do you do this with like any kind of book discussion or book group? That it's always
right. It is, and the way you see it is always different, depending on who the different factors that you're interacting with are, you know, and the different perspectives that other people in a book group bring to a table. Or,
mm-hmm.
yeah, it's like, does the reader create a different author? Yeah. Do
yeah.
people looking at your, and I guess I can get into that a bit more when I think about visual art, you know, does each viewer create a different painter, depending on what they're bringing to how they're looking at it? Like those people who say, you know, all that stuff about modern art and saying, oh, my kid could paint that. You know, the
right.
perspective that they're having of the painter is so reductive and, you know, demeaning in some ways, but it's really their own issues that they're bringing to the viewing of it, or their own lack of ability to think outside of what they know in some
right.
ways. That then,
right.
you know, they're creating the artist in a very demeaning light.
Right, and is it just because they feel separated? Like, this is not something I'm going to be allowed in.
So I better hate it already.
Right, yeah. Right.
And I think it's very interesting. I often get torn, and I still don't have a conclusion on it. When you look at a painting, do you look at the label with the author, with the artist's name first, or do you look at the work? You know, and I have a hard time with that. Like, sometimes I look at the work, and I don't like it. And then I look at the name, and all of a sudden I'm like, oh, okay. You know, it's this artist creating it in this style, creating it for these reasons, and these are all the cultural, you know, signifiers that I know of. And now I can look at it, and I can see why they did what they were doing, and okay, maybe I still don't find it aesthetically pleasing, but I like that they did it, you know? And so that relationship between the difference of just viewing something aesthetically as an object with no knowledge whatsoever about the context of the creator, or knowing about the creator, and then how does that affect what you feel about just the actual object, you know? So I think about that a lot.
Right, and I go back of the same thing, that when you encounter something new, do you need to read about it first?
Do you need to know the context?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Or can you just view the piece in its own right? And, you know, a lot of people would say, well, you just need the piece. You know, all you need is to look at what's there. And yes, that's very true for things that are aesthetically pleasing, you know, that are made to look good. But, you know, art has the right to be uncomfortable and to not look good and to not necessarily make you feel good. And, you know, and so a lot of people, that'll make you shut down if you don't know the context around why they're making something that is uncomfortable. You know?
Right.
I don't know. Because people don't necessarily always want to put themselves in uncomfortable situations unless they're challenging themselves. But I think you also need to be, it takes a little extra effort to be open and vulnerable with something that right away you can tell, or, you know, might have signs or signifiers of things that are not easy to chew on, I guess. Does that make sense? I'm just sort of
that idea of putting yourself, you know, as a viewer putting herself or himself into the image or object, or you kind of imagine, you know, you're kind of transporting yourself into it in a way.
For example, Cindy Sherman here is a really great example, right? When you just look at Cindy Sherman's photographs, you're like, oh, I've seen this a million times, right? You're like, yeah, it's a, you know, Mary Tyler Moore style shot, little woman in a big city looking up all scared and everything. But when you learn the context that it was a female photographer who was also the subject, who was also framing the shots, who was putting herself in all of it and was actually forcing us to look at the male gaze in society everywhere, it totally changes the way you look at the actual object. But then recently, I don't know if you heard about, do you know the artist James Franco? Have you heard of him?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Yes. So he's also getting into art and that sort of thing.
Okay.
And so he just last year recreated a lot of Cindy Sherman's early stills with himself as the subject and then reframed the shots. But then I don't know if he was trying to be like a male ally to feminism or a male, you know, feminist male or that sort of thing. But at the same time, his pieces were then right away picked up by the Pace Gallery in New York. And so there's like really, it's a fine concept for a guy to like, you know, reframe misogyny or reframe sexism and, you know,
right, but then are you just...
But then you get to leap to one of the biggest galleries in New York, both because you're a male and famous, totally goes against everything.
Right, and it goes back to what you were when we were talking about other cultures, that are you just going back 30 years in time? Yeah. And picking up a stereotype and is what you're doing is just bringing forward.
Yeah.
Is that what you're bringing
sexism
culturally forward?
Right.
Is an old, even an, you know.
Did he, yeah. So.
An old stereotype.
Yeah.
Not even a new one.
Right. And you think you're being edgy. Oh, that made me so angry. I was like so angry for weeks and still am. But yes, but so I guess that's kind of like that part of the conversation.
Yeah.
Anyway, so. By the way, your work is beautiful and aesthetically pleasing and also very sort of like intellectually stimulating, just in the sense where you can just kind of look at it and just get lost in it. And it's very impressionistic, which I think allows for many inroads for the viewer to see what they want to see in it. You know, in the piece, like, you see a landscape, but it can be, you can feel the emotions of the landscapes you've experienced in your past. Or maybe it's not a landscape. Maybe it's, you know, a string of lights somewhere. You know, you can really find many different points of context with it. When we were talking about uncomfortable art and everything, I wasn't trying to imply that your art was uncomfortable.
I think that there is...
Or what I've seen of your art.
And that experience of place is so important, that idea that even if I'm working from whatever kind of images in my head or things that I do work a lot by going back to the same place over and over again, and which is one of the things I like about coming back to New York. When we lived in Minnesota, we actually came in the summer every year and stayed here for a month or two every summer. So I've had this Western New York connection for years and years. Mm-hmm. And then when we moved here 8 years ago full time, I think that, you know, that other kind of landscape transition for me was being able to, you know, kind of be full time, seeing all the seasons in one place, and that those there are these. I guess it's that kind of physical memory that you have of something. Yeah, that it's not so much that I need to remember what were those physical elements that were there, but how you felt about that environment you were in, those landscape cognates that we were, and that one place can stand in for another place. You were talking about being on the West Coast, and, you know, you're experiencing the same kind of weather you'd have if you were in England. You know, that there are these things in our big globe as you go around, that one place can be another. Or we were talking about the film, you know, like with photography, yeah, with it, you can use one place to stand in for another. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what is it? So why should place even be important then?
And is it feeling, really? And in some ways, is it, you know, like, you know, perhaps more traditional realist landscape painters, sure, they try to document the minute details of a landscape, but are you really getting the feel of it, you know? Or is it something that in some ways is even less accessible because it's always just an object that's interpreting a space, whereas when you sort of create something that's looser, is it providing more inroads for the viewer to feel something rather than try and document something that is never going to be the real thing?
Right. But I like that. I like that that correlation idea, and that takes me to mapping, mm-hmm, and that this, you know, that you're not making a one-to-one. All of geography is just a kind of mapping. You know, we're describing a place. That's, mm-hmm, and so that this is a very particular kind of that geography, and that these places that exist because for reasons that none of us understand, we hold on to them, and so I think. There's one fellow who always says to me, "Oh, if only you'd put a person in, I'd just love it. Just one person, just one. Can't you just give me one?"
At
some point, there's gonna, and I think there's
a brushstroke,
right?
No,
right,
like, there
right,
is
right, and I think I've got things that refer to parts of land, you know, trees and things that were put there because we, you know, a human put them there, and are referred to a human scale. And I think that's maybe I'm just kind of always assuming that the viewer is that person, mm-hmm, that you're the one reading the map, so that, you know, you're not in your own little picture, but you're the one looking at that place, and or you know, some
Charlie was the same way. Charlie Birchfield was the same way. You know, he rarely depicted people. And actually, and I'm going to butcher the quote, but, you know, there's one quote where he said, when I depict nature, I am not trying to capture what you see. I'm trying to capture what's really there.
Mm.
You know, and that distinction.
Right. Right.
And so that's why his landscapes are so expressionistic and are in some ways hyper-factual. You know, he would do these all-day sketches where he would just sketch the cloud formations hour by hour to really show their progression. And, you know, as you can see from the botanical exhibition we have downstairs right now, he was an incredibly skilled draftsman and incredibly skilled at, you could say, factual representation of nature. But for him, it was more about how does this feel, you know? And for me, that was really powerful when we got to go to Salem, Ohio last spring, where he grew up, and we walked in the woods that he walked in his town, and we saw spring wildflowers that were some of his favorites to paint. And in his paintings, you know, these things like Trillium and Spring Beauties and Hepaticas, they're just these monumental flowers in the paintings.
Right.
But when you see them in real life, they're so tiny. They're spring flowers, so they're very, you know, they're very conservative with their energy. They're just little shoots, you know.
And right.
They're not showy at all, but for him, they were just like these massive signifiers of spring, you know. And so I really love that about his work, and certainly that also makes me wonder about how you view yourself. You know, your work, as we've been touching on, is not purely representational, but do you view yourself more in a expressionistic perspective of more of an abstract perspective, and what is that relationship, and it doesn't always have to be one or another,
right,
or anything like that,
right,
but.
Right, because I feel like I love the Birchfield quote, that, you know, that idea of not the thing but the thing itself.
Yeah.
And so I'm not trying to
thing.
Right.
Yeah.
And so how do you that kind of trying to both, you're both, yeah, so you're both trying to summarize, you are trying to represent and summarize, but you're also just trying to express this pure thing. So I think, so it is very, it definitely, that connection to abstract expressionism, but it's not just a free float. I definitely am starting with a palette that to me is evocative of a time or place, and then I love what you said about the hepaticas and the signify that the sort of the scale relationships of the color and that goes back to earlier in the conversation when we were talking about being in Los Angeles, that the color could be huge because you have all of these different, you know, these different kind of environmental influences, and I think for compared to, I said, like, growing up in Nebraska was wonderful because it's like things really are as big as you remember them. Like, you go back and it really is that big, and I feel like with the environment here, with returning here, that what I'm trying to kind of shape or put into perspective are those. So some of the things, the color is much more subtle. I mean, I think it's, you know, it's not that it's less of a palette, but it's just, it's very specific. Like whether your blue is reading January or June, you know, it makes a big difference, and that you know, it goes those sort of I am trying to consolidate this kind of environmental information, but not, you know, not in a way that is certainly not in a real, you know, not in a.
And I also want to say, you know, we've been talking about your work from the perspective of landscapes, but I don't mean to limit it to just landscapes, you know, because so would you say, and I, you know, have not seen the totality of your work, but would you say that you mostly do landscapes, or you'd mostly do evocative, you know, works that are evocative of natural spaces and landscapes, or do you find you also do other things? Like, you know, I'd like to hear, I don't know the answer, so I'd like to sort of hear your thoughts on that. Are they landscapes or aren't they? Do they have to be?
Mm, you know? I feel like there's the landscape. There's the landscape element. I think that and maybe that mapping idea that it's not that some of them that are where the some of the things that I'm doing, I think the landscape theme continues through, and that so a lot of the way I'm using layering now is, and I'm collaging one, like a thin paper over a thicker base, and to me some of that is trying to get at that scale of representation. And I think the thing that's one of the things that I always return to and like are just photographs, going back to look at photo, and I love to look at old slides, old photo, you know, just how that space gets consolidated, and you know that you're how much, you know, depending on the scale of the thing, like the map, you're either seeing this huge area or this small area. And so I think the thing that I'm trying to use now or explore now is having are all the layers showing you the same amount of space, or is there or that ability to kind of
scale
right and right scaling up, but still maintain that you know where we can find ourselves, that we need, I guess, yeah, that there's got to be something that's a little bit of a wayfinder.
Mm-hmm. So otherwise, some of your pieces could be viewed as pure abstraction.
Right. But then I want it to be as simplified as possible, I think, or concentrated. Mm-hmm. So that, how do I kind of taking whether it's the color or the whatever physical reference, and trying to distill it down to something, and then, but I think that there's you and so now it's using the physical shapes and forms and things that come out of the materials that I'm using, and letting those in turn create that those references to a physical world. But it's just what's going to happen when you spray water on a palette and let the water is going to do a lot of work, and I'm just letting that happen, and then I'm picking it up and sort of taking that, you know, that moment in time, that snapshot of that interaction.
Mm-hmm. In some ways, that's a lot of respect for the natural components of what you're making as well. You know, like the natural way that water is going to move. You know, you're respecting that, and that's very cool.
Well, and I love, I think that yeah, I just love working with the paper. Love and I love watercolor because it is immediate, and it is you've got to let the paper breathe. The paper has to have room to breathe. You have to kind of know what you want to maintain, mm-hmm. and you don't have the. I think right now I've just really been sticking with as opposed to working with oils, where I can just keep layering up, and you can always go back in and add the white in. That's not a problem. Mm-hmm. But if you're using using paper as your base, you have to let that be where you have to a little bit map out what you want to mm-hmm. maintain, mm-hmm. but let things happen at the same time. So how do you balance? So that for me is the joy of it, is balancing those two things out.
I'm sure you spent some time looking at it, but I think Fireflies and Lightning downstairs is a really great example of that. You know, because you can kind of look and you can see. So to create the fireflies, he would glue down these little circles that then he would paint over and everything, and then peel them up, and he'd have the white spots of the paper, right?
Right.
But for some of them, I don't know if he just forgot about them. I can't imagine that, but maybe he just decided that actually, no, he didn't want fireflies where they had been, but rather than painting in where the little circles had been, he just left the little circles. So you've got these little brown circles of adhered to the top of the paper, you know? And for him, very much, you could always see the process. You could see the charcoal strokes, and you could see the pencil lines, and you could see all of that. So
right, but the working for it. I mean, that's what I just love, is just
the process.
Having, you know, you're using all that water, but you're using it vertically,
yeah.
Which is
it's all about the process for him. And that was, and as we know, having the archives and that sort of thing. But also, there's a few other little fireflies where clearly they weren't white enough. They didn't pop enough. So they, like, scrubbed out the paper, and the paper's all really abraded and that sort of thing, just where these little fireflies are, where I can just imagine him with an eraser or the butt of his brush or something scraping away at the paper, you know, it's...
Or it kind of got... we were talking about newsprint and archival. Yeah. There'll be things where, you know, if I'll lay down a little bit of paper, and then you walk away and you leave it and it dries, and then you come back and your piece of newsprint is stuck to your beautiful piece of archival paper. Yeah. And so you have to get it up and get it off. Yeah. So.
And I think about, you know, what are we seeing the evidence of?
Right. And right. And that being willing to have that trail that sticking with that idea of wayfinding, that theme of, that I feel like for me that this kind of what I'm working on now and getting ready to do this show in the spring with Elizabeth Samuels, that idea of wayfinding is very important, or kind of making a path that you're both, and maybe it's sort of how you, I don't know, is it like the when you add to the little stack, where, you know, every time someone goes by, and then they'll add a little stone to a path so that you know somebody's been on that trail before you.
Breadcrumb or trail.
Those little accumulations that people have been here and that those trails intersect.
I love watercolor for that reason.
And so I think that maybe is what I was when we were talking about those layers of scale. It's also that those layers of points, finding those points of intersection and allowing them to come out. So I like that idea of the circle, you know, that was meant to kind of hold the space, but then in the final painting, it's much more fluid. It's not like this, you stuck a pin in something and there it is. And when you look at that, fireflies, those things are moving.
Yeah.
They're not fixed.
Most of the time, people don't notice it unless I point it out and say, you know, look at these here. And they're like, oh, you know, it's right there. It's like totally eye level, but you just don't notice it unless somebody points it out.
Right.
And I like to, in some ways, you know, getting back to the thread between the viewer and the artist, you know, with Charlie's work, how does that strengthen the ability for the viewer to perceive the artist, you know? I like to look at his coffee stains, you know, on sketches and that sort of thing, and, you know, why a whole bunch of his oversized cartoons, which are on transparencies, but the point is, like, you know, it's like, but in some ways it's, like, still really beautiful because it is this evidence of a whole lived life and these sketches that were not always treated with, you know, cotton gloves as we do now, and were rolled up and thrown in corners, and, you know, and but you see all the evidence of that. Anyway.
Yeah, well, I like that idea of evidence and accumulations, and I think that those... And that with the layering no matter what my process is, like, each layer is sort of done independently. I have some idea about how I want them to fit together, but I really don't know until the very end how they're going to come together.
And what is that discovery like for you? You know, when you are viewing these pieces, like, do you ever go back and say, no, I need to adjust an earlier piece to make it work with this later piece? Or is it, you know, for example, when you have a triptych or something
right.
like that?
Yeah, I think, well, especially using the collage layer, since I'm making the sort of the different paper layers separately, and then I'll work on a whole lot of kind of final layers, and I'll, you know, and then I'll lay out the base layers, and then I have the top pieces, and then I'll be just shifting them around. And so those just stay on the floor of the studio, you know, because I'm working on things that are, you know, roughly like 30 by 40 inches, you know, so I might have...
So you have multiples at once.
Right.
Yeah.
3 to 7, you know, base layers, and then the top layers, and then I'm moving them around until I feel like that there is a sequence that works, and that idea of moving, that I think that even though I'm not trying to represent a place, but I want your eye to keep moving as though it's that it is looking
moving
at a place.
Deeply into something.
Yeah, that that you're coming in and out of a space.
Yeah.
So that's so that final thing gets fixed down, and then yeah. So then sometimes, usually they'll just I don't really add something to the very top unless it's like really adding a whole nother layer, like putting a piece of one even more fine. I use a lot of that conservation, that the paper that gets used to repair books, mm-hmm, and that you know, so sometimes I'll add a real final layer of that, because I like the pieces to not necessarily have to be behind glass, mm-hmm, so I'll use a wax medium and just an archival wax finish. So I might, you know, put a layer of tint underneath that, just that there's something that's going to unify a group that I want to hang together,
right,
or stick together.
Yeah.
That definitely was part of making the ones, yeah, we'll look at.
Since you mentioned that you have a show coming up next year,
yes,
would you like to talk about that show a little bit? Or your thought? Are you at a stage where you want to talk about it? Or are you still figuring it out?
Well, I think, as I said, I think that it's definitely going to be about I think the elements that are coming together are using those collage layers. I think right now I've been looking at a lot of old photographs from different periods. So I like that idea of, you know, when you're capturing an image of a big place, like what are these parts that come out at you and stick in your brain?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's really what I'm focused on right now. What are the things that bubble up?
And where is the show going to be?
It will be at Indigo Gallery with Elizabeth Samuels. So, and, you know, which has been, you know, part of the, you know, kind of what's been important here in Buffalo for me, working with Elizabeth. That's how I met Catherine Parker, was when, you know, she had a show there and when I first moved to town, and that's how I got to know her, and then was fortunate we got to do a show together, which it was just a great experience for me to, mm-hmm, get to be part of this community of artists. And then,
yeah. And yeah, I don't know Elizabeth that well, but just she is, you know, curating just phenomenal exhibitions and selecting really incredible artists. I don't know if you saw what's her name? Augustina
Droz. Yeah. And I love her and then talk about skate, you know, that she,
yeah,
was doing the tiny things, but then her
really
wall,
big.
Her big things on the wall there, and then out on Grant Street,
yeah,
you've got the murals going,
yeah,
and the,
yeah,
so she's a fabulous painter.
Yep, she is. Oh, yeah. So I feel like we've touched on a lot of these things, you know, very organically. We've talked about your creative process.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about some different themes in your art. I think we've talked about what you create and why you create it and influences for you on that. I'd like to ask you, lightly, you know, it doesn't have to be a big thing, and sometimes I feel like this question is kind of cheesy, but, like, what do you hope to achieve with your art, you know, and sometimes I feel like that's putting too much of a fluffy feel on it sometimes, like, sometimes you don't know what you're trying to achieve, you know, and that's kind of the sense that I've gotten through. These questions have not changed since we started the project in 2012.
Right.
And as I've been going through this process, you know, the answers to that have been radically different. But what I like about it is I do like kind of keeping the questions the same, because I like seeing the different answers. And I like seeing the people who scoff at me. And I like seeing the people who get really genuine, you know. And I like seeing the people who actually can't answer that, because it's so intimate to them that it's not something they can share, you know. So anyway, that's all of my preamble. But, you know, what, if anything, do you hope to achieve with your art?
Well, one thing is I'm in it for the long haul, I think, has definitely been part of just that, being able to just immerse myself in different materials, and I think yeah, using kind of these ephemeral materials in a way, but then you have to solidify them, and I'm trying to come up with a form that lets people, I think I, you know, I still want to come up with something that lets people in and lets a viewer, you know, find herself or himself in a place. But I also want it to appear seamless, I think. So I think it's that trying to find that seamlessness, mm-hmm, that is what keeps me, you know, trying over and over again.
It's really cool that you're playing with seamlessness when you are doing collage, when you are doing these multiple layerings, you know, these things that inherently have seams, but how do you change the way you look at them?
Right, and I think, yeah, and that moving, I guess, kind of, you know, I guess as a subject matter, I'm kind of fascinated by margins, you know, mm-hmm. I like water, I like, you know, things where you're looking, you're on the edge of one thing and looking at another. And so an edge is a margin, it is a barrier. So how do you get over that barrier? So that back and forth just keeps me going.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's wonderful. Cool, thank you. Yeah, that doesn't have to be a big question, but I wish that I had that question, what do you hope to achieve with the art, before the little plug for Indigo Gallery, because I think Indigo ties in with my next question,
okay,
which is, you know, as an artist who has been, you know, exploring her craft for, you know, many years now, and you maybe might find yourself sort of at a mid-career point, what are some things that you've had to do to advance your career in the arts, and what did that look like maybe in different places? Was that different in LA than Minnesota, and is that different mm-hmm. than Buffalo, you know? Mm-hmm. But kind of talking about that a little bit. When I do these interviews, I often imagine my ideal listener. And that doesn't mean it's the only listener or the only, you know, the only participant, you know, from the divide that is you and I and then the listener on the other side of the audio interview and the way they're... Anyway, but I'm imagining somebody who is either exploring... pursuing a career in the arts, maybe exploring going to school for a BFA or an MFA, maybe mm-hmm. out of high school, maybe out of their MFA program, maybe out of their, you know, just people who are, what I think is really incredible about the Living Legacy Project is it's an opportunity for very honest insight from artists who are at different stages in their careers. And so I always want to take an opportunity to highlight what that looks like, not to, because, you know, for many people, making art is one thing, and having a career in the arts is a different thing, you know, trying to put mm-hmm. yourself out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not even talking about, like, you know, doing it for financial stability, but I'm just talking about, you know, what it takes to put yourself out there, market yourself, and make people aware of what you do. And to many artists, marketing yourself is a very dirty word. And I get that, you know, but also we live in a capitalist society, you know, and all these different ways and perspectives. And I don't necessarily agree with artist capitalism.
Well, but also, if you're involved with something that you want to share, yeah. So I think that is part of the capital that you yeah. you can't just be, you are trying to communicate yeah. with. You talked about an ideal, you know, you're trying to reach someone
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
somewhere.
Yeah,
and I think for me, with those the different communities that I've lived in, different cities. Just kind of affiliations with teaching. I haven't been teaching at a university setting because, you know, I had kind of the alternative education background in terms of not getting an MFA, but I've been able to work and affiliate with museums or with working with young students, working when I came to Buffalo. I've taught with Bryant Street Studios, mm-hmm. Did children and adults, taught bookmaking, and that led to working with Just Buffalo Literary Center. So I was part of their Artist in the Schools program, got paired, where we were, which is still ongoing, but you know, getting paired up with a poet or another writer, and then I would do a hands-on bookmaking project with the students. Mm-hmm. So those kind of those teaching affiliate, you know, kind of they're you know, kind of studio based, and they take, you know, kind of translating what I do in my own studio, but trying to come up with a way that a hands-on way for people to engage with my process. So that has, I think, been my most consistent way of reaching out and both building audiences and then getting, you know, but just being able to share the joy of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How often do you, like, submit artist packages and that sort of thing?
Oh, right.
No, it's all of it, you know.
Right. So then there's, so definitely in terms of putting together whether they're kind of gallery proposals or, and I think, you know, what's changed over time, for me, was just going from working with group, like definitely in Minneapolis, I would work with groups of artists and we would put together prospectus or proposals for shows, for group shows, and just like come up with a theme. And that, and I think that, that was, for that stage of, where career development or just that was a very effective way. And as you said, that sometimes somebody can just throw out an idea for something that you're just really taken with it, or it gets you to do something that you didn't do. I did a lot of book portfolio, print portfolios and participating that way, so that then I would just submit one print out of a group, and then it would become part of an exhibition. Mm-hmm. So definitely the over the last 15 years, it's been much more of a transition to just having solo show or small group shows or solo shows or things that were actually part of what led to the show that I'm doing with Elizabeth at Indigo, was talking about doing a monoprint show, since I am there, Mark Levitel, there are all artists who are Kathleen Sharon, people who are using monoprint as the, not necessarily the sole part of their work, but so I think they're just like those kind of happy connections that come about.
And certainly, we were talking about this before we were recording, but you're a member of the Buffalo Society of Artists, which is a large and very historic artist network here in Western New York, and Buffalo specifically, which, Mark Lavatelli is also affiliated with, and Mark is going to be hopefully involved in the Living Legacy Project next year.
Oh, that's great.
So, yeah.
Right. But. Yeah, and then, they have at a minimum of two member shows a year, and then other like special thematic shows. And the same also, I'm a member with Niagara Frontier Watercolor Society, and it's that being part of those groups where you could have, as many submissions over the course of a year as you could keep up with, that it's for coming into a community and being part of a sustaining member of the arts community. They're doing a lot for, and I like with both organizations that they are representing some generational shifts. Mm-hmm. They've got people who've been practicing here for many years, and then they are attracting younger members, and people who are coming back into also just working with different materials. So and now I have the past 3 years I've had a studio over at Trimaine. Mm-hmm. And so that's been a nice, I have a home studio, but then I have the studio over there where I kind of moved the parts of the process that I'd rather have. Originally I took all the oil paint and moved it over there, and now I've kind of moved some of the acrylic paint, just that I'm able to, and so I'm able to work on larger sheets of paper, use the paint, and just have an easy place to manipulate and work. But then the studio mates I have, they all like, some like having the door closed, some like having it open. We get to know people. They do some of the, they're part of the kind of Buffalo Cultural First Friday. So they've got the fourth Friday of the month. So the doors are open and people drop in. So again, it's just another way to get the exposure and have people find you. Working with Grace Maibaum in East Aurora, I had a show with her that was, just a great experience. Talked about Joe, that he would on Saturday, he would just come over to the gallery. That it was just it really is a community hub. It's not, and I, some Saturdays I'm there and there'll be, people coming in who've never bought art before and they're just starting out, and it's. So you're watching people just get involved with the whole process.
That's really powerful. Grace is wonderful and very, very dear to our hearts.
One of the projects I got to participate through the Watercolor Center here at Birchfield Penny was doing last year. I did one of the videos, and so that was a great experience.
one of the videos for the live watercolor workshops?
Yeah, well, I went over to the studio here on campus and then just worked for an hour and had the whole process recorded.
Awesome.
So they were trying to start a little bit of a record keeping archive, how people work, and I had participated as a speaker, both as a speaker and a kind of workshop leader, and then different levels. Mm-hmm. So again, going back to just kind of different ways, I think for that teaching component has been just kind of consistent and important to what I do and how I move forward, because you do get to connect with people in a different way.
That's exactly what I was going to say. It's just, it's all forms of connection. We've spoken about the Buffalo artist community in many ways, and you're incredibly well, connected to many different nodes of that. But when you look at your needs as an artist, what do you see are some needs that perhaps you have that you're having a hard time meeting that you could see the community helping you with, helping you achieve?
That idea of kind of the regional component that West, had, I think the quality here in Western New York is so high, and again, it's just a real kind of career spanning from, we've got this, so many great resources, and I love the idea of somehow, how can we kind of bottle that up and take it to another region? How can we, obviously, like the barge prototype is a good one, but how can we make sort of some smaller groupings and then in turn
get an actual barge.
Right, that if there's a way, going back to that, maybe getting back to that kind of group prospectus idea that, is there something that we could then share with another region that is a like region,
That's why I'm really interested in this penny trail thing, because it seems like a way where if we can create a network, granted, it's using a database that ContentDM, the network building, how can we talk about what it is to have dispersed collections throughout a community? And how can we pull that back together into one narrative, that sort of thing.
Right, right. Well, and I think with the watercolor initiative here is a great model. So I think are there ways to then, this institution has been a host site for national meetings, and then could we then participate in other, other places by sharing what we have.
And even it doesn't mean going that far, It could mean going to Erie. It could mean going to Syracuse,
Right.
What if we took more field trips as Living Legacy Project artists and just went throughout upstate New York in different ways, looking at smaller artist communities? What if we went to Watertown, which actually has a really vibrant, small sort of Potter's Guild arts community up there? And what is, what do all these things look like? But
Right. Yeah. Even I was part of the Patterson Library project that just exhibiting at the library in, is it Mayfield or
the Mayfield, quite possibly
Mayfield,
there's,
and I have a lot of I have art hanging in the mansion on Delaware that that's actually a very sold a lot to people from Toronto, because we do have these connections with these people coming to us, and
in some ways, even when it comes to more community building here, do you know about Sugar City?
Oh yes.
Yeah. Okay. I would love to see something like a BSA member show at Sugar City or something like that. Where doesn't that just seem like two ends of the universe? Where it might be an opportunity to both celebrate what Sugar City is making happen, taking on a huge old building, taking on both renovations and also respecting the slightly demolished space, but also looking at the history of the arts. But how can we, while in some ways kind of taking BSA a little bit out of its ivory tower,
mean? Right, right. They have a whole age spectrum of members, so they need to, and maybe what they just did with their show down at High Temp.
Yeah,
that's again a step in that direction that they keep exploring. Cool. So that.
Do you have anything else you'd like to add about from where you are now? What would help advance your artistic career?
Well, I No, I feel like that, you know, that projects like this, that, you know, what you, that idea of the web, that being part of a web network, or, you know, just the visual network that it's more than just my website. You know, I have my, and I'm, you know, trying to do my own archiving and trying to keep my own records, but then to have that be feeding into the records that you're keeping and sharing, and having it be a way that people can find their way to different individual artists, that for me is a very exciting, like, next step and or just ongoing thing, and the so I feel like those connections, right, that you know, it doesn't even necessarily have to be that the physical art travels, but just that the information is traveling. Mm-hmm, so I think that that's for me is definitely a big support system, because it's certainly for any individual artist, it's a lot of work to keep your own archives and keep your own, just doing your own documentation of your own work is a huge amount of time for each. And so unless you're at a point where someone is doing that for you, it's something you really have to take responsibility for and budget the time and the expense to do it.
Yep. That's very true. And what's nice too is that, you know, when it comes to archiving your work, other than just like putting things somewhere that are dry, really, a lot of times it's like you're just creating the archive by just doing what you're naturally doing. You know, if you create studies for, I mean, well, mm-hmm. you know, maybe, I don't know if you do or not, but if you create studies, just label them on the back with the year and what the ultimate piece is, and then just put them in a dry corner somewhere, you know, and make sure you don't put newspaper on top of it or something like that.
Right.
But, you know, it's often the accidental byproduct. You know, it's not something that has to be that intentional. It'll just happen on its own, so long as you keep it in a safe, dry place.
So, well, you make it sound very simple.
Stress.
Right.
I mean, but then sometimes it is a lot of work. Like, for example, I like to say Charlie Birchfield was an archivist's dreamboat because he would make a whole bunch of sketches and then say he would be working on, so sometimes he would make sketches and they wouldn't be connected to any piece, but say he was later working on a piece, he would pull sketches from all sorts of years, which granted maybe doesn't help with chronology, but that's okay. He would pull them all together and they would put them in a folder and label them with the name of the piece that he was working on. You know, so you have all the sketches together for what would later support the final piece. Or for when he was working with John Bauer, at the Whitney to do the retrospective there, I believe it was John Bauer, he created painting indexes for all of his works. Now, that was a massive labor of love.
Yes.
So he not only documented a photograph of the painting, if possible, dimensions, materials, when he painted it, who he sold it to, and if he had the information where he painted it, which it was really helpful for us when we went to Salem, Ohio. You know, we were able to go through the woods because he would draw little maps, and find the places where he most likely painted. But we have these books for most of these painting indexes for most of his career. And even though they're certainly not comprehensive and he was making them after the fact and did forget some pieces, it is the first point of access to validating the authenticity of a work. So he really did us a good turn. Doesn't have to be that stressful.
Right.
He was kind of type A. Definitely seemed a little type A. She said very, very lovingly. Well, my last question is kind of based again on this sort of mental listener, somebody exploring what it would be like to really pursue a career in the arts. What, and this also is a hard question for some people I've learned, saying what advice do you have for emerging artists? And a lot of people say to me, well, I don't know them. You know, I don't know who's listening, and I don't know, like, advice is a very intimate thing. But, so then I'll sometimes change that and say, okay, well, if you could look at yourself when you were first starting out as an artist, knowing what you know now, what advice would you give to yourself? So either, if you would like to answer either of those sort of variations.
Well, I think that, you know, the advantage someone right now has, because I think the important thing would be the getting it out there. And that if you, just having the ability, you know, we were talking about Joe Orfeo at the very beginning and how he was in his 80s, I believe, and posting new images, and just using and doing it in a friend, you know, what it was just as a friendly thing, but it's also he was just sharing.
That's what he wanted to
and
do.
and getting a response. And so it's sort of what you were talking about, things that are, they don't have to be stressful. And but it's a way that you're moving forward because you have done that sharing. And so, you know, to be able to compare to 30 years ago, that, you know, this is fabulous to just be able to share something immediately. And not that we're doing it just to see how many responses we get, but it's part of just this kind of immediate support network, you know, that like all of those, you've got your friends, your art friends, you've got you've got these great and easy connections to people, and so such a perfect system to get everyone united. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of those two things, you know. I feel like it's a great time to be an artist.
Mm-hmm. Well, Monica, do you have anything else you'd like to add before we close the interview?
I really feel like everything that, you know, being, since I've moved to Buffalo, just being part of the Birchfield Penny has been just a great part of my life. I've been, you know, volunteering here, and then through the Watercolor Institute, had the opportunity to teach and speak, and then to participate in this, the Living Legacy Project. It's all been a wonderful experience.
You've been a wonderful, you know, support and friend and part of this family, and that's what I love about the Birchfield. As someone who, you know, when I first started volunteering at the Birchfield in 2006, volunteering at openings at the old museum when I was like 19. And what kept me coming back and what has been the reason that I moved back from Vancouver was the connection with this community and the connection with this family. And it always felt warm, and it always felt like there was an opportunity for conversation and discourse. And it is a family, you know, and it's a very expansive family, and one that, you know, needs to continue to grow and relook at itself as we are in this big new shiny building now, and making sure, very much in my opinion, making sure that we're still respecting our community roots and speaking to that. But I think that the relationship you've had and continue to have is a big part of that. And, you know, the energy you bring is really, really phenomenal, both as an artist and as a friend and supporter. So, and I genuinely mean that.
Well,
I'm not just saying
you.
That for the interview.
Thank you, Heather.
Well, Monica, thank you so much for coming in today to participate in the Living Legacy Project. We're really grateful to have you as part of the Living Legacies, as Bethany Krull likes to say. Oh, no, Bethany Krull likes to say, we really like to have you as part of the Living Legends, as Bethany and Jesse like to say. But thank you so much for coming in today.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.